Thank you, members of the Budget Committee. On the NPO side and the NA side, we also have the chair, Mahaya, on the NPO side, and we all know each other, and the way I think Charles and I work, well, I hope we would agree, is that we co-chair it. So there's no need for either of us to ask permission from the other speakers, both in the same status, at least in theory. Let me not be provocative. Over to you, Charles. Do you want to say some preliminary remarks?
Chairperson Karim, thank you very much. Thank you for this opportunity that we as a collective can have this meeting jointly regarding a matter that concerns both committees. We dealt with the New Development Bank initially, but there was a certain part of the contingency reserve that we didn't dealt with because it was not ATC. In the meantime, well, ATC. And when the committee secretary, Mr. Wickham, sensitized me of this meeting, I sent a request, can we do it jointly? Why? Because the personnel and the stakeholders from 10 years from Pretoria, if we have to duplicate this meeting, it means in monetary terms, it's a big expenditure. And the finance, we want to cut from that. So thank you for this opportunity, Director General. Thank you for being here to honor this meeting. From our side, Chairperson Karim, apologies for Honorable Motara, I think he's out of the country. The Honorable Van Brandes and Honorable Zandi, because of sick leave, these two members have a serious health problem. And when we play, we must think of them as well. So that is the apologies from our side. And welcome to our members from the National Council of Provinces, the Direct Committee on Finance. Thank you, sir.
On our side, we have Prince Kekane, who is not well, and we will sorely miss her. And we also have Bjorn Todd, who is not coming, and won't miss him at all. But, I said the obvious thing, we miss Tink because she's not here. We will miss Bjorn at all. But he's not here also. Right. And this thing will proceed faster and be more productive, given that Bjorn is not here. Now, let's explain the concept very quickly. There is something I must disagree with you, come very soon. And it's fact, we're a broad national democratic movement. We have traditional leaders and feminists and Marxists and free marketeers like the DGJ and so on. So I want to say, it's not an honor for the DGJ to be here. It's his job to be here. It's an honor that he has been invited to Parliament, the other way around. Not many DGs get an opportunity to appear directly before the committee as often as he does. But on the most serious note, welcome DG, welcome FHC. DG, I hope you impressed. We hold the FHC 2 weeks ago, and we exchanged them rigorously, and therefore you can see the funding you will probably you'll have to allocate to them for a smooth answer. Already, he's coming in value. Right, having said that, very quickly, on the New Development Bank, the members from the Standing Democratic Finance won't agree, but let me stop the chair for them, right, because I'm not just a party political hat. I'm supposed to represent the whole nation. So I want to say that. When we engaged with the DG the last time, members raised some useful questions, but in my view, they were not like alert and as lively as they at the time that you were not here. Because there is some very interesting questions. They claim they raised it when you were here. My view is they terrified of you and intimidated by you. So when you were here, they didn't raise those issues. When you were not here, they were like coming forth, right? Somebody's going to disagree, I don't care. That's it. So a lot of new questions arose. As I understand it, Chairperson and committee members on the NPOP side, the broad sort of trajectory is that obviously we identify and support the New Development Bank, that we would hope over time, bearing all the sensitivities of our own to go to the National Assembly, I'd say, that actually it doesn't become another IMF and World Bank, and that it plays some role over time, without being, like, let's say, naive and simplistic about what's possible in terrain, TV. We would like to see this bank emerge to be more developmental and more sensitive to inequalities in the developing world. It's a developmental bank from a developing set of nations. And we also noted that the Asian Infrastructure Bank is also in that. And we interested Greece and other countries are increasingly other countries connecting with it. So we would like to see this bank not be IMF and World Bank Mark II. The second issue that arose, Comrade College, is that the Center for Applied Legal Studies made various proposals to the committees of all of us, and they raised issues about the need for civil society activism and so on. So if you take the first point into account, that the NDB should be different from IMF and World Bank, and even they allow for civil society activity, and some of us, Makosi and me, even went to a structure that is oversight over the World Bank and the IMF. I think you might have been to the structure before. So what we said is, in fact, let's hear from Parliament, let's hear them. I believe the National Treasury has replied to them in some form or another, and let's the National Treasury reply. But remember also interesting that the FSC has taken this about the good and financial institutions. So that's how we are here. So also to clarify, after talking to Advocate Jenkins and Alan Wickham, that we can actually, we had thought that the way Parliament had allocated the respective parts of this thing was complicating to come vote. But we are told we can vote. So the aim is for us to, in principle, finalize this matter today, if possible, on our side, and I'm not sure what the procedure is, and then vote on it, in fact, next Tuesday. Or even on Friday morning, if it's possible. I can't figure out what it's going to be, it's a little matter, but, you know, we can discuss it later. So that is the aim. So those are the preliminary remarks. I don't know if you want to add anything before we throw it out to the meeting. Okay, over to you, CLS. Can you give you 15 minutes? Because we've got a written submission. Okay. You'll introduce yourself.
Good morning, members of the Standing Committee. My name is Norma Danyanda. I'm an attorney at the Center for Applied Legal Studies. I'll hand over to my colleague. Good morning, members of the Standing Committee. My name is Barney Kwala, and I'm a candidate attorney at the Center for Applied Legal Studies. The Center for Applied Legal Studies is a not-for-profit organization, and we're a human rights organization, but we're also a public interest law clinic. Our work varies across a number of projects, including basic services, human rights, business and human rights, environmental justice, gender, and the rule of law. We take a three-pronged approach in the way in which we deal with these programs, and that approach is that of research, advocacy, and strategic litigation. Particularly in light of risks and human rights, which is why we're here. We, for example, have done advocacy work on the BRICS New Development Bank, which includes the letters and submissions that we've made to this committee, and of course, presentation we're making to you now. We have also had a podcast that we've had broadcast, which was done by the Institute for Business and Human Rights. In terms of research on our business and human rights work, we're working with Berman Gilfillan on expanding on the meaning of ESG, which are environmental, social, governance standards, as set out in Regulation 28, and creating a guide on how pension funds can implement the S component, which is the social component, and an illustration of the strategic litigation work that we're doing in terms of business and human rights. At this point, our studies is that we are working on a case in which we're trying to ensure that human rights, that developmental projects, that finance institutions and their clients and infrastructure development projects ensure human rights compliance in the project. The purpose for our presentation today is to, first and foremost, we set out in the letter which we sent to you that we firstly wanted to ensure that the ratification process of this British Development Bank was open and transparent, and that there were participation from civil society and affected communities. And we appreciated that this invitation goes somewhat of a way towards fulfilling that demand that we have set out in that letter. And secondly, we wanted to ensure that the British New Development Bank was its human rights compliance, and that is the purpose of our presentation today. We will begin firstly by discussing the creation of the BRICS bloc and the formation of the BRICS New Development Bank, which the need for which arose from the violations of human rights by Bretton Woods institutions and the manner in which they finance their projects, and that these violations were actually failures in light of the African framework on human rights. And we will show what the Standing Committee can do to ensure compliance that this bank complies with human rights in terms of the African framework, and to show how the standing committee can ensure that the BRICS New Development Bank is different from these breaking rules institutions. So the BRICS bloc was founded in 2008 and South Africa joined in 2010. It's a group of five rapidly growing economies, Brazil, Russia, India, China, South Africa. It's also a part of the G8 and part of the G20, and the group together holds 20% of the world's gross product. As was discussed in last week's presentation, the BRICS New Development Bank will fund infrastructural and sustainable development in BRICS and other developing economies, and it will also assist with, it'll be a departure from BRICS and most institutions in that, working with regards to the initial capital will be equal for all countries, whereas voting in the DRA will be dependent on contributions. This is a departure from the voting with institutions in that, as you'll see on the next slide, voting is skewed towards the global north and developed countries. This is an issue because the countries that are dependent on funding from the IMF, from the World Bank, as you'll see on this slide, the countries that are dependent on that development finance are primarily in the global south. And their voting shares in the BRICS institution are not equal to the contributions or not proportional to the contributions which they make. And the funding that comes from these BRICS institutions often comes with conditions which are not conducive or advantageous to the global south, to the global south context. And they also often result in the violation of human rights. And we're here today to show you how the BRICS New Development Bank should be different in this regard.
Okay, my colleague has discussed the existing framework for financial institutions across the world. What she's demonstrated is that these institutions are headed for the most part by countries from the global north, and that when funding is provided to countries from the global south, that it is often attached with conditions of the restructuring of economies. The reason we are setting this out is because we are clear, and I think the chairperson of the standing committee has made it clear, that the British Development Bank, the New Development Bank has to be, and is intended to be, different from other development institutions or funding institutions. It's supposed to not only provide funding for development purposes, but do so in a manner that is consistent with the developing economy agenda. So I will continue my presentation by speaking about the way in which British institutions have provided funding in the past and the human rights impact these have had. I have three examples in the presentation. The first is one of the Ogoni land in Nigeria. As I'm sure you know, oil was found in Ogoni land near the Niger Delta, and a number of organizations corporations have invested in this particular region. But what it has meant for the extraction of oil, what it has meant is a great deal of environmental degradation, as you can see from the pictures, a great deal of violence committed against people within that region. And the violence is obviously a human rights violation, but I want to make clear that environmental degradation in and of itself is also a human rights violation. Without the environment, we don't have clean water, we can't grow food, we eventually lose the ability to survive. And that's what's happening in Ogoni land. The second example I have up there, just to draw the link between the oil in Ogoni land and the World Bank, the Nigerian government has promised to be able to pay back the funding that has been provided by the World Bank using the money that it gets from the particular project. So with regards to Honduras, the International Finance Corporation is a private body of the World Bank. It provides funding to private institutions across the world and has provided funding to a corporation operating in Honduras that farms oil, palm oil. This particular corporation has actually influenced the context in Honduras and has led to a great deal of human rights violations, forced disappearances, the killing of people, taking people's land, resettlement and relocation without any kind of compensation. Clearly an indication of human rights violations that has been funded by Global North and is obviously impactful for the Global South. Next slide, please. The third is the Inga Dam project. There have been two phases of this Inga Dam that have already taken place. What we've learned is that the project has actually resulted in the resettlement, the relocation of people living in that area. This has deprived them of the right to survive, the right to farm within that within the river, the right to water from that river, and also the right to benefit from what that river is actually supposed to do, which is provide hydroelectricity. This is obviously unacceptable. Unacceptable for a number of different reasons. Firstly, development is not supposed to be just for corporations. Development is actually supposed to be for the people living within a particular country. They are the people that are supposed to benefit from development projects. A project that not only resettles people and takes them away from their land, but actually deprives them of that benefit cannot be said to be development. So what is clear from this is that the new development ban has to be quite different in that approach. Having shown what development finance can do, we are also going to show what human rights framework actually exists for the new development bank. Next slide. Okay, so I will speak of the rights to development on the African continent. And this right, you may think, okay, what does that matter to the New Development Bank, which is a bank that essentially only has one African country in it, and has four countries, one from Latin America and three from Asia. The right to development actually has a global impact. The right to development has been stated in the UN to be a right. There is a declaration on the right to development. So it's not really just it's not supposed to be just a governmental agenda. So we want to note that the right to development is a socio-economic right, so it's a right to socio-economic development. The African Commission have made it clear that development, in order to be development, has to be equitable, non-discriminatory, participation, accountable, transparent, and equitable. The overarching theme is that development has to be a choice, which I think is foundation for why we're here. We are here to say that the New Development Bank should not be created. We are actually a very big proponent of the New Development Bank. We think that this bank has been created for people in the Global South and to serve the needs of people in the Global South. But in order to do that, there are certain guidelines that need to be put in place. And we can use it. What we've said is that the New Development Bank has to include some elements of choice. So the kind of projects that it actually finances have to be projects that people actually need to fulfill their development aspirations. And people should have the opportunity to speak about those particular projects. And this is also aligned with the right to development. So that's speaking about development as a human right. The next step is what's clear is that development has to take part over a variety of different steps. It has to take place before a project actually is undertaken, during a project's continuance, and after a project has been completed. So if you're building a road, that road certainly has to be developmental in nature. So it can't only serve the purposes of corporations or large businesses. It has to serve the needs of community members. Secondly, community members have to have a choice in whether or not that road should be built. So before that particular project is put in place, let's say, in this instance, a road, community members should be able to participate in the actual decision making. They should be involved in the very conceptualization of that particular road and should be consulted. There should be accountability, responsiveness, and openness about that particular project, its selection, and its implementation. One important principle of international law, and particularly of developing economies, is the principle of ethics. This is a notion, it stands for free, prior, and informed consent. What it essentially says is that community members, especially indigenous and marginalized groups, should be given the right to actually consent or not consent to particular projects, so that projects are not imposed on them by the state or other interested parties. During the project, members of the community should be able to participate in the actual decision-making, but also participate in the project itself. It does not make sense for a development project to put in place, but supposed to serve the needs of country X or community X, that doesn't include community X members in that particular project. If you're building a road, community members should be able to work in building that road. That is development and that is beneficiation. And after a project has been completed, again, consultations need to be continued. If indeed this particular project, let's say in the Tesla Road, has led to human rights violations, community members should be given the opportunity to take part in remediation. This remediation can take on a variety of different components. It can be compensation, monetary, it can be reparation, so restoring the land to what it used to be, or it could be giving them alternative reparation, so giving them alternative land that is similarly situated. It could also be non-repetition, a promise that this is not going to happen again, and also an admission of wrongdoing. It is very, very important that communities be given this opportunity. One important aspect is that communities should also be given the right to grieve or to complain if a particular project is harmful to them. And that brings us to what we're hoping that the Standing Committee will do about this. There are three things that we're hoping the Standing Committee will do. The first is that it will encourage the Treasury to put in place a human rights policy. The second is that it will encourage the Treasury to put in place a grievance mechanism for the Registered Development Bank. And I want to be clear that we're here in South Africa doing this work, but we're not alone. We have partners in Brazil who are doing similar work with the Brazilian government. So we're not asking Treasury to do anything that the Brazilian government isn't going to be doing either. And we're not imposing on the new development bank anything that we have not requested of other development banks. We've made submissions to the World Bank on the World Bank sector. So investment is an ongoing thing for us. We have engaged with the African Development Bank on the Johannesburg principles, and we have also we're also working on another institution within the World Bank. I can't really deal with the details of that. So the first thing is the committee actually encourage the Treasury to put in place a policy. The second is we'd like to encourage the Standing Committee to encourage the Treasury to insist on a grievance mechanism. And the third is to encourage demand some sort of remediation. So with regards to the first thing, we'd like Treasury to, along with the national treasuries of the other countries in BRICS, to put in place a policy that speaks about human rights, that has safeguards that ensure that human rights are complied with. The second is that we'd like there to be a clear articulation of ethics within the policy of the new development bank. The third is we'd like to ensure that this new development bank, that the development deals that it undertakes are not undertaken in secret without participation of community members. So the policy has to state that development projects are equitable, transparent, participatory, consultative, that include principles of accountability and inclusiveness. The fourth is that we've made it quite clear in this that the environment is an important aspect of the world in general. And what we'd like to say is that environmental health is not just a notion that green people abide by. It's actually a human right. So that this must be clearly articulated and protected in the policy. And also that a policy that is adopted actually has a human rights due diligence process that actually proactively to prevent human rights violations. With regards to the second point on grievance mechanism, we'd like to ask that the grievance mechanism actually be put in place by the New Development Bank. This is not a new thing. The World Bank itself has the compliance advisory of an ombudsman institution, so this is not a departure from international debt standards. This particular institution, in order to be effective, however, has to be able to make binding decisions on the new development bank. It can't just make recommendations. It should also allow aggrieved people to approach it directly. It helps no one if only the states are allowed to approach the grievance mechanism for grievance reprieve. Secondly, the third thing is that the grievance mechanism should be reviewable by an independent human rights-based court in whichever country it is located, possibly even an international human rights-based court. And the final point about remediation, just to reiterate that community members should be able to take part in remediation processes and that a variety of different remediation measures be provided. We thank you for your time. Our contact is just to speak information. What we've done is, in case of context, of development finance. We've indicated the need and the impetus for the new development bank and the potential impact of development finance. We've also indicated that development is a right and needs to be inclusive. And we've asked, we've made a few recommendations for the standing committee to make of the treasury. And thank you for your time.
Very much. I think we should just go ahead with the three inputs and then have national decisions apply and then they're open because they overlap. Is that okay?
Yeah.
Okay. So the next one then is FSC. 15 minutes at most.
Thank you, Chairperson. Thank you, honorable members. I think whilst Henry is putting this presentation on this, let me just make a few comments, and then as soon as he's done that, I'll ask Dr. Ramot Mabuku to take you through quickly through the presentation. Let me first of all say that we very much appreciate the invitation to come and make an input on this particular matter. I just want to say that as the Financial and Fiscal Commission, this is actually the third time that we have had to engage officially, whether it's with the executive or with the legislature, on the matter of the BRICS as an institution. So we very much appreciate this invitation. However, I must say that when we got the invitation, we also were quite happy to come and have this conversation, probably as an initial interaction with yourself, because we have been working on a conference with UWC. There is a day that is established on the BRICS, which has a theme on multi-level governance issues around BRICS as an organization. And so we've been working with them on a conference, and we are basically in the preparation for that conference. We will be dealing with the fiscal decentralization issue and the implications of the BRICS in a very broad sense. But we want those issues around the BRICS thing. So it's a very welcome engagement that we will have with you. So this will be the first set of thoughts that we will share with you around some of the issues. We've been thinking about them silently, but we intended to invite you as well to the conference that we'll be holding jointly with the University of the Western Cape chair on our level. Let me Chairperson, without wasting time, because we've got 15 minutes, I'll ask Dr. Mabuku to actually quickly go through the presentation and then we'll have a conversation around.
Okay, thank you. Good morning, honorable members. I will essentially touch on two main issues. First is quick understanding of our rationale and assessment of the new development and the contingency reserve arrangement, and then go into four issues that I want to flag for Parliament to consider when dealing with the new arrangements. And these are issues around our understanding of the funding and budget process, the cost-benefit analysis which was raised by members when we had an interaction with them last week, intergovernmental fiscal relations aspects of the new arrangements, and then other dimensions, and in this case, speak on the South African resistance. Everything. So the four issues illustrate the way we've been thinking around the issue. Now, in terms of overview of the initiative, I won't go into too many details here, but the proposal is essentially two separate institutions. The contingency reserve arrangement and the new development bank, and our colleagues from the parliamentary budget office discussed this at great length when they made their presentation last time that we met. So I won't go into a lot of detail on that. But the contingent reserve arrangement, it's important to understand that this is a virtual institution. In other words, no real institution exists. It exists in virtual space and only gets called upon if the contingent arises, if any need arises. So, funds for the contingent will be sitting in individual countries up until there is a need to respond to the contingent. The new development bank itself is a natural institution. The institutional structures are set, will be headquartered in Shanghai with a regional a center in Johannesburg. So the two aspects, a virtual and a real institution, are in place. Now, what is the context for the proposal? Well, the main context here is that there was a major gap in development finance for long-term infrastructure and sustainable development. And departure by the United States in particular from its expansionary fiscal policy led to large outflows from emerging economies. That had significant impact on the exchange rate. So as a result of that big hit on exchange rates for emerging countries, when the U.S. pulled out of expansionary fiscal policies, domestic fiscal policies, there was a need for this major response. Now, there are a number of arguments around the new development bank that need ironing out. The first set of issues is this really a snub to international financial institutions? And from our assessment and discussion with colleagues that are now dealing with this, they are feeling that this is not really a snub to international financial institutions, but needs to be viewed more as augmenting what is currently on the table. So there are issues around whether this was a snub to international financial institutions. Is it a way to dodge hoops imposed by international financial institutions? Our assessment is that not really, because when you look at any development finance institution, at the very minimum cost, it has certain conditions, and we're going to be likely conditions for this new institution. So it's not really a way of dodging the hoops that affect another institution, but more of a augmenting decision. And the very end, and for us, this is actually the core reason for this new institution, is that it is run by local or southern actors. This is where it is very different from other multilateral development banks, for example. This is where you have majority shareholding and majority voting being invested in the BRICS countries. For the other institutions, it's always that there is either a developed country or developed institution that has majority voting rights in those institutions. But in this particular case, what distinguishes it from the rest of the banks is that ownership structure. So as a result, one could argue that it's really a way of attracting funds or investment and keeping that within BRICS or complementary countries in the emerging country world. Now, why an international and coordinated approach? Well, essentially, two types of arguments that one can appeal to. The international dimension was critical because at that stage there was lack of adequate private sector financing to go around. Coordination was critical because of the massive cross-country externalities that took place when the United States, for example, pulled out of expansionary fiscal policy. One country couldn't go it alone, with perhaps the exception of China, if one says it, but most of these countries are by global standards small open economies that can't change the global dimension acting on their own, so you need a coordinated approach. The other aspect is around the foreign debt of local currency of the new initiative. Why? Well, it reduces systemic a risk that's associated with foreign exchange lending to unhedged borrowers. The contingent reserve arrangement tries to protect against volatility and overdependence on the International Monetary Fund when one runs into a bilateral payment problems. And to protect from that volatility and stigma from the International Monetary Fund, for instance, the applications for the contingent reserve arrangement are kept secret. So the IMF doesn't know who is activated that 2020. That way, no country can be stigmatized when it does an activation. Topo does it done properly, encourage domestic saving and investment. That's the bank arm of the arrangement. Well, why now? I think it's quite clear that there's significant post-crisis common ground, especially among the emerging countries, much stronger than before the crisis, within common ground. Regulators in particular are moving very aggressively, forcefully, against foreign exchange prerogatives and requirements. So there is a need to be responding to a foreign exchange situation. Then there has been a shift in global geoeconomic power and relations that warranted that such an arrangement does take place. Now, what are the concerns? Well, like all other banks, the new development bank will still have to ensure a commercial viability. So it can be a sovereign institution, but still it has to ensure commercial viability. And it must do so even more when a large part of the resources it lends are going to be mobilized from the market. So the commercial viability element is still going to be a large part. What about concerns from the contingent liability asset? Well, while the guarantees for governments would improve the institution rating and reduce the borrowing costs, it's important to realize that if the contingent arises, then the costs have to be borne somewhere by the guarantor. So if you send money aside to guard against a contingent from happening, it doesn't absolve you of paying up when the event actually materializes. And in our discussions, it turns out that on this aspect, when you look at most of the multilateral development banks, this aspect has never actually been activated. A lot of them have it in place. The African Development Bank has that facility in place. The Asian Development Bank has it in place. But there hasn't been an instance where it has been called upon to bond the cost of the contingent actually materializing. Finally, all socially relevant concerns, which are the things that we discuss when we are talking developmental states and the kinds of things that our colleagues that spoke first were talking about, all those concerns will still need at the very least to yield a return which is adequate to cover costs and deliver a nominal profit. Otherwise, they won't be financed. And the reason why they won't be financed is because if you finance those kinds of projects, then the bank won't be able to meet the commercial viability constraint. So those are the hard realities of what confronts the especially relevant concerns. They will still have to generate an adequate return and contribute a minimal amount to profitability of the institution for it to be sustainable. Now, coming to the issues we're dealing with the standing committee on finance, but I understand now that we have the other committees only for Parliament only. The first is around funding and budget process issues. In our opinion, the new development bank would have an equity stake which is drawn from each member country. Then guarantees as well as some form of credit set up to a certain threshold, all in forex reserve, which would be for the contingent liability. So that's the two elements for it. The articles of agreement contains the self-executing clauses. In our initial opinion, we thought that there does need to be an act for this new institution, much like the Development Bank of South Africa has an act which gives expression to it. We were thinking along those lines, but now it turns out that the articles of agreement have these self-executing clauses, which means that soon as it's operational, then they will automatically bring the institution into existence, thereby circumventing the need for a separate act for the institution. The equity test, however, would have to be budgeted for over the medium-term expenditure framework. That's what Treasury is for, Department of International Relations and Cooperation, Department of Trade and Industry, or Department of Economic Development, depending on which department is taking a lead on which aspect of the initiative. And in all cases, there has to be some sort of arrangement to deal with the current fluctuations, the current reserve fund. The contingent liability portion, CRA, could be handled as other provisions are currently handled. We have a lot of provisions of this nature currently in place, and from our initial assessment, there is nothing preventing this from being handled using similar kinds of provisions, except that it will be denominated in foreign currency. Now, South Africa is liable for $2 billion in respect of paid in shares. And in our assessment, there is actually no compelling reason why that equity funding should be a first charge of the revenue fund. We found no compelling reason for it to be a first charge. And in fact, should be factored in through the normal budget process. If it bypasses the budget process, then legislation will have to be enacted by Parliament to exempt it from the National Revenue Fund. Our view was that the funding could come either from the national share, since it is foreign policy or international finance factor. Our further discussion with colleagues, we've been reassured now that the arrangements, proposals that are in place, that the contribution in fact will be running through the normal budget process, which, as you can see from the yes.
Member, I just missed the point, but we can allow it, but it's not a reasonable reason for intervening. But go ahead.
In our assessment, with it running through the normal budget process, we think it should come from the national, from the national set. Because it's essentially a foreign policy, international finance function. Okay. So that's our point in terms of whether it should be first called on the budget, and in terms of the budget process, what part of the budget process should finance the equity part of the institution. Now coming to the contingent liability, should it be a first call on the budget or not? South Africa will be liable for $5 billion US dollars in respect of callable shares under the contingent reserve arrangement. That is actual proof that I spoke about at the beginning. This need not be a part of the budget. There are similar government commitments which are reflected as provisions. And provisions are defined currently as liabilities for which payment debt and amount is uncertain and are reflected in the statistical table section of annually published budget review. Our view is that that contingent liability could be funded by either a ring-fenced fund, much like the unemployment insurance fund, except that it's a foreign currency denominated, US $5 billion in this case, or it could come from the contingent reserve fund. Asked to choose between the two alternatives, our view would be that our preference would be that we deal with it through the contingency reserve fund, and the reason for that is because it's better suited to deal with unforeseen changes. That will be our opinion on that matter. Now, the proposed arrangement is that the contingent liability is going to be sitting on national treasury books because they are custodians of all things assets and liabilities for the country. And for us, that arrangement does make sense in terms of oversight of the parliament exercises, because with management of assets and liabilities being a core national treasury function, then the liability position can be reported on every 6 months, as currently happens, through the budget review, estimates of national expenditure and medium-term expenditure framework. So there's no need to build up new oversight structure on it, because that structure already exists. It just needs to be now updated to say every time you come and also report to us on CRA position. And the reason why you want to exercise oversight on it is because of the foreign currency denomination. It has a lot to say about credit rating for the country, ultimately, depending on movement on that aspect. Now, the second set of issues, now that we've done the budget process issues, was the cost-benefit analysis of the arrangement. Well, the whole BRICS formation, in our opinion, to do a cost-benefit analysis here, the benefits essentially run from lower cost of domestic trade, a larger domestic market that South Africa is going to ultimately have from the association, and then foreign direct investment that will likely materialize after the association becomes operational. So that's the benefit side. That's the implied benefit side. In a rough approximation around those three areas, the reduction in domestic market costs, the larger domestic market, because now you're dealing with initially at least five countries, not just one country, South Africa, when you look at the market, and then foreign direct investment. What are the costs? Well, on the cost side, the first cost is that you'll be living with people with different cultures or races. We all know what can happen if you don't actually invest in dealing with people that are different from yourself. Then people start killing each other on the basis of the differences. So it's a cost that needs to be set at that front, that we are going to have to invest in dealing and living with people with different cultures and races up front on the cost side of cost-benefit analysis. Then there will be competition from imports, particularly for the South African discourse, this will be around the issues in textile, for example, what is likely to happen on that front. Then there could be other issues of malpractices that our colleagues that spoke to first were talking about. Those are on the on cost side. And ultimately, for a cost-benefit analysis, you want an equilibrium which says the optimal size is where your benefits actually exceed the cost. When you weigh those benefits against the cost, you want the benefit to be above the cost. So in terms of the channels, those are the channels. What that illustrates is that the benefits are not going to be through notions of national pride or culture or other related ideological issues, but they're just going to come essentially from how we trade, domestic market implications, and those intergovernmental relations. That's where the channels of benefits are going to come from. It's not going to be through some other ideological associations or issues of pride and so on. It's purely the market related factors of it. So that just says if one were to do a cost benefit analysis around all those channels, what kind of information will they be requiring? Because we haven't actually done it now, I think I'll move to the next slide on our edit on cost benefit analysis of new development then. The quantification of those costs and benefits are almost impossible to do at this stage. And the pieces of information that you require and that we don't have are that you need to know the new development bank's lending and project selection criteria in terms of minimal level rates, return on investment, for example. So those pieces of information we don't have. If you have that information, you can put actual numbers onto that schematic that we drew. If South African proposals eventually start competing with other BRICS countries' proposals for a limited pool of funds, then there's no knowing at this stage how many of South African projects are going to be successful in that competition. So you can't, again, quantify cost-benefit analysis without that information. Our ability to secure lending would ultimately depend on the ability to package the projects in ways that would be attractive despite the collectionary nature of the finance involved. And so in terms of oversight, we think the main oversight will be that packaging of projects, be it through the national infrastructure plan or some other plan that will be in place, is where a lot of the extensive oversight should really take place, so that the packaging speaks to the developmental developmental needs of South Africa. Now, as we say, government is really in a better position to advise on project preparation that's been provided for, especially in measures to ensure that the projects are ready for financing. And then we do get that information essentially as we contribute others to do the exercise. Okay, the one other aspect that I can just pick up on our basic cost-benefit analysis is the issue that we don't fully understand here, which is high implications for the cost-benefit analysis, which is that while the new development bank is supposed to be complementary to China's new Asia Development Bank, it is not clear from the documentation that we have what that will mean in practice. Yeah, so the relationship between the new development bank and China's new Asia Development Bank needs to be built out a lot more so that we get what it actually means in practice. We're not able to get that sense from the documentation that we received. Now, the third area, remember I said four, so now I'm on three out of four. the third area is around intergovernmental calculations and new development banks. Okay, this last diagram is also just schematic on the relationships that one can map between the new development bank and South Africa's intergovernmental fiscal relations from national government, provinces, local governments, regional governments, here you can, non-governmental organizations, the unions, and on the extreme left, the parastatal organization, state-owned enterprises, and state-owned companies. So there is that those relationships running through with implications for each one of those players up and down that need to be taken into account. Again, it's schematic. What is our verdict on those impacts for South Africa? Focusing particularly on provinces and municipalities at this stage. Well, our first point is that because no province or municipality can borrow in foreign currency terms because of the Constitution, Borrowing Powers Act and the Public Finance Management Act, then it would have to go through the national route in any case and be unended in South African currency, much like the arrangement for the campaign state. And mechanisms are in place on how to be dealing with that kind of borrowing. So initially, if you insist on municipalities and provinces not borrowing foreign currency, then the vehicles exist on how that takes place. Now, the new development bank articles of agreement also allow the option of financing certain projects in local currencies. And herein we see quite an opportunity, which when in local capital markets could actually help avoid the underdevelopment sub-national capital markets that we have here in South Africa. And in terms of packaging of the projects, one could think of a scheme where there are nice developmental projects located in areas that are not interacting heavily in the capital markets. So one way would be to see projects from those areas that are currently not utilizing the existing financial arrangement. But then, because South Africa has got a very well-developed financial system compared to the other partner countries, what you also have to guard against is that you don't destabilize our financial system. Because if now a lot... Sorry. Oh, how that happens? Yeah. Okay. All I'm saying is that there will be a new player with government guarantees coming into the financial space, and you want to ensure that that arrangement doesn't stabilize your already functional financial system. And ultimately, it's a part of oversight to ensure that you keep the good habits that you have and make sure any new arrangement augments the good habits that you have. You don't want to destroy the world-class financial system that you have. The final other dimension is just the new development then, because of its international mandate, would of course fall outside the South African reserve and jurisdiction. But presumably we think it will yet comply with Basel standards. If there were to be a banking crisis in South Africa, and the country were to make use of Greek currency reserves, then
there would be need for involvement of the South African Reserve Bank as a draft Twin Peaks crisis resolution legislation. So that's the final issue to really pick on the draft Twin Peaks crisis resolution legislation. Thank you, sir.
So, you took well over twice the amount of time, but the committee was supposed to intervene and tell you that, so he didn't, so I was quite fired. I think the reason why I think we allowed you some latitude is because of the detail that you are including, and one can't be mechanical, so I think Al is going to say, we were given 15 minutes, we stuck to it, we were very competent, very pithy input. There was little more you could have said to make an impact, let me assure you. And quite frankly, I wish politicians were more like you, excluding me, of course. You're to the point and precise and a lot of depth in what you say. It reminds me of the 1980s and where I was, but you know, let's talk about that later. So, PDO, you are in house. You've spoken already. Not more than 15 minutes. You only need that, right? Part 3.
Thank you, Chair. In fact, we'll be less time than that. So, as per, we did the presentation last week to the committee. I think members of both committees now have the hard copy of that presentation. And I think we're set.
One procedural matter. You see, the NCOC site hasn't had your input. So I thought, in fairness to them, presumably you can also go and address their committee when they ask you to. Can you give them a little overview of what you said so that they're on board? Is that what you have it as a committee? We remember we have two committees. Yeah, I'll come to that.
Okay, thank you. So we haven't quite anticipated that, but I think what I was going to say is that we're comfortable that given the presentation from our colleagues at the FSC, documents provided by National Treasury, and the response to National Treasury will give shortly the issues that have been raised by members last week and by the presenters, but any relevant issues about the contingent reserve arrangement that the Select Committee hasn't dealt with will be covered, I think, in that process. So the one thing we were asked to comment on was the Centre for Applied Legal Studies submission, and as members mentioned last week, this is something that needs to be seen in the context of some of the rationale for establishment of an alternative lending institution, in that historically there's been a view that some other lending institutions have used conditionality relating to human rights to maybe unreasonably impede lending. So that's the view. The fact that this institution has been established with that in mind doesn't necessarily mean that it will go to the alternative extreme and not take issues into account, but from our point of view, it doesn't have much in the way of implications for public finances, which is really what the PBO is supposed to deal with. We see it more as the two main issues raised by Cal, the ones about the process by which Parliament includes their input and the input of civil society. I think that's for other colleagues in Parliament to deal with. And the other issue is about the consideration of human rights in the lending process of an institution that is set up with capital from the Republic, and I think that's something that our colleagues, National Treasury and Legal Services, may be a better place to comment on. So that's the really extent to which we have comment on that. The other point, so the important points that really were raised, I think, by our presentation last week, and which have been raised also in the FSC presentation, relate to the... So the important points that we raised in our presentation, and I think also were raised by members and forwards to the National Treasury, relate to the detailed implications of these two arrangements, the New Development Bank and the Contingency Reserve Arrangement, for public finances and for the economy as a whole. National Treasury gave some indication in its presentation to the committee, I think on 28th of April, at a high level of the possible implications of the capital contribution, but the details haven't really been spelled out, and obviously it's up to the committee's, the extent to which they would like detail. But the point, which is clarified also with our colleagues from Legal Services, is that once treaties are ratified at Parliament, then those will be binding on the Republic, and by implication, any financial implications will need to be met by the Republic, regardless of what the committee then thinks about the details of that stage. So to the extent possible, it would be desirable if National Treasury could provide more detail in response to the questions raised by the members. And just to, I think, reiterate the point made by a colleague in the FSC, which we also made last week, is that the contingency reserve, well, for the new development banks, there's paid-in capital, which is $2 billion, and which needs to be paid in, I think, 7 installments over a certain period of time. And that will have a direct impact. There's also callable capital, so we could be called upon to pay in more money at a later stage. And so in one case, we just have fairly clear commitments in terms of what we're going to pay, and maybe National Treasury can provide more information. In the other case, there's potentially a risk of capital being called upon, and it would be useful to know what National Treasury thinks in terms of the possible implications of that for public finances, in particular the fiscal framework. Then on the other side, you've got the contingency reserve arrangement, which really involves our existing forex reserves. In both cases, we're not giving away money. We're essentially lending money in different ways. When it comes to forex reserves, it may not have any direct implications for public finances in terms of expenditure. But, for example, we came across one view expressed by a credit ratings agency, where the individual noted that by committing to this agreement, one could view the forex reserve that South Africa has committed to the agreement as being in some way ring-fenced, and some credit rating agencies may then consider those to be outside their normal calculations because they're committed to an alternative agreement. But as with the new development banks, there are lots of potential benefits of this arrangement in terms of protecting South Africa's currency, but to the extent that we might need to commit some of our foreign reserves to another country that's experiencing a currency crisis, there are also risks. And I think the point raised by the members in the context of the cost-benefit analysis was what is the expected balance of these risks and benefits in the future? And again, I think that's something that our colleagues at National Treasury are well positioned to address. So I think that's the main point we wanted to raise, Shepard.
Finally, before the DG comes in, these are among the questions that were raised. I don't have a copy of the thing. Yeah. Just remind members, I'm not sure it catches everything. One, it would be useful, said the committee members last time, for the committee to get a clear indication of the likely benefits and risks of the CRA for our country. What are the expected economic and other benefits of the NDB? Presumably there are some more immediate costs and benefits, while others are expected to be realized over the long term. What is the balance between these expected costs and benefits? Three, will there be a preferential borrowing rate for member countries or projects? For while agreeing with the desire to depart from the conditions of the IMF and WB, how will that balance be found between this and ensuring the NDB members' contributions are protected? Next, can more detail be provided relating to the likely cost to South Africa of setting up the NDB? If possible, a clear statement of the expected impact on the fiscus would assist the committee in its consideration of the future. So that's the full set of issues. Now, I know members are bursting to ask questions, and it's not usual that we allow stakeholders to have such a long say before we intervene. But given the nature of the issues, the character of the debate we're having, where we are at the moment, the deadline and so on, regrettably we'll have to hear you, you know, before members can come in. Because obviously, you know, if you require some of the issues, it will sort of provide a narrower framework for our discussion. So can you respond to this?
Thank you very much. It's a whole lot of issues and questions that have been raised. I was thinking as people were making the comments and so on about where to start, and I hope I'm right. I should start by explaining what these things are one more time. And in that process, probably explain what they are not, so that we don't talk past each other. And excuse me, those of you who will hear some of what I'm going to say for the umpteenth time, don't think that I think very low of you and your class of staff, but it would help to do that, so that when we then engage and misunderstand each other, we misunderstand each other talking about a cow, if it's a cow. But it's not a half a cow, half a donkey, and in my case, I'm standing on the right-hand side, I see a donkey, you're standing on the left-hand side, you're seeing a cow, you know, and we kill each other. We must just walk around it and say, oh, now I see this thing, it's donkey on the side, and a cow on the side. So we know we're looking at half a donkey, half a cow. Now, let me do this. Let me start with some just clarification of the CRA. I went to town on the day I was explaining, to say, correctly characterized by Dr. Ramos, it's a virtual pool. It would be interesting to hear, for instance, if it is a virtual pool, why a rating agency would say it wouldn't include the amount we have indicated willingness to commit towards the virtual pool. It would be interesting to hear their argument. But my question to them would be, if we needed money now, why would you want to take a position that suggests that we can't use it? Because it's available, it is our reserves, it's available to us. Why would you want to take a view that suggests that we won't have the money? First question. Second question would be, why on earth would you choose to say, when we now have the possibility to have $5 billion more US dollars to access in foreign currency, you see that in the negative instead of the positive. It would be interesting. Right? In other words, I buy insurance so that when my car crashes, I can get another one. But you want to convince me that because now I've bought insurance, I am poorer, and if my car crashes, I will be even more poorer. I just can't understand that logic. In fact, let me just say bluntly, it is illogical. So, it's just what they say. You see, when a conversation is between adults, you know, what are we talking about? So that we don't talk past each other. I made the point the other day. Again, on the contingent reserve arrangement. Which was that most people, and I can understand this because they don't work with these things every day, we have the reserves. And because they have, by definition, to be in foreign currency, and South Africa only uses within our borders rand, it means they only have meaning if we save them in countries that use the dollar or euro. You can't keep, it's not even allowed law for individuals, for example, to keep dollars in their pocket. Banks, they've got to be authorized dealers in foreign currency for them to keep the dollars. So you can only save dollars as a country now. Because outside of South Africa, you can only do that. Because then in that case, the US people are not surprised because they deal in dollars. The European people are not surprised because they deal in euros. It is your money. In exactly the same way, it is South Africa's money, in exactly the same way that individuals are creditors to banks when they save money with the bank. Right? It remains South Africa's money. Now, the other point that I made, it's related to the question that has been raised, was that some people then ask, now there is a risk because you are going to be giving the money China, Brazil, Russia, India. As if there is no risk associated with putting it wherever it is today, it may have a different profile. Right? So in other words, we are now investing the reserves in bond debt in the U.S., bonds in Europe. In effect, we are lending to those places. But we have to do it because even if it pays nothing, I mean very little, let me say not nothing, but too little, actually. We have to do it because that's the only way you can manage the reserves. That's the only way. Now, we will face a risk, but it may be a different risk now because it's a different country. Carry a different rating, yes, and all that. But in return for it, not only do you get the interest, but you get, because we'll not be lending it to them for free. We'll be lending it commercial terms, reflecting the risk associated with that. But you also have the issue that now it is five countries that have come together. They have got the terms for how long, under what conditions and so on, worked out before any one of them needs the resources. It applies to us as it applies to others. That's the first benefit, the fact that you have got an arrangement, an insurance that people know upfront, as I made the point the other day. So when people look at our reserve, they say it's 50 or so, let me say. I mean, I don't know where the exact number, they change every hour depending on the movement in the current. But what happens is we've got that, but now we've almost bought insurance over and above that. In addition to the fact that we qualify for facilities at the IMF by virtue of being shareholders, top members of the IMF. And we qualify for an amount calculated usually on the basis of the size of our GDP. By the last calculation, this is affect around $29 billion. So it's all of these things saying, look, let's fortify in this very rough world our position, where we can partner with others so that our vulnerability externally is reduced. Let's do so. I don't know if I use the example quoted on the day. It was in September and of 2013, was it, when India's currency was under massive attack. Some of you might remember the time, but September of a particular year. And they had to enter into a bilateral swap line with Japan. And just the minute they had done that, I don't even know I can track it to the committee if they did draw it down. I mean, to the extent that they may want to communicate this publicly. But the moment they had signed the line, they ceased to be looked at as just India and its own reserves. Now they have backing of Japan. Right? It is that kind of stuff that we're looking at here. Some of these things, just the announcement may carry more of a positive lift than the actual using of it. Now you ask me to put a price on that, I'm not clever enough. I can just describe to you what these things mean in broad terms. Now, why then did I use the analogy of a cow, donkey, depending on whether it's half donkey one side? No, let's do donkey, not mogot. Let's use donkey. We shall be safe. Honorable, let's say this. Now, people sometimes misunderstand these things, and I can understand because they don't watch them every day. Now, none of the members of parliament know where we invest the $50 billion reserves that we have. Ma. And they don't have no. If you ask, you can tell. But you don't have to know. There is no law that says we must come and explain that. It's also, by the way, very important that that information you keep quiet about it, because one day you may have the reserves, let's say, in Spain. When Spain goes under, if people know that you have the reserves there, they, by association, they quickly say, now that Spain is in trouble, South Africa will be in trouble because this money is pending there. You see what I'm saying? So we mustn't create the impression that when we do this thing, we do it quietly, under the table, we keep you in the dark. It's a new thing that we're keeping you in the dark. We have always been keeping you in the dark, figuratively speaking. All we do is to say to you, there is $50 billion in reserve for good reason. It's not everything that you tell, which is, you know, yes, there is a place for transparency, but not where capital markets are involved. Say today I'm thinking this. Then the market will sort you out. By the time you act, you are dead in the water. Now, sometimes we demand, you know, a level of transparency that's not prescribed even in our constitution and law. So let's not introduce it here. That would be my caution.
This time around, the school this government does not respect it. Part of that one is the government.
Let's give the issue the opportunity to reply in full, please. Yes.
What you could also do is join the
Let me then finish the point here, and I hope that I'm covering most of the things on the CRA. By making an even more serious point, which is that often we may overlook it. When we have put a dollar in reserve, let's say, in the U.S., and there's a negative relationship, just stick with that and trust me, there's a negative relationship between the value of a bond that's written on its face and yield. In other words, what the bonds pay. Now, the yields move every minute. Every minute. If you take them in the morning, depending on the transactions and the mood and perception about risk, and you take in the afternoon, you will see couple of basis points movement. Sometimes not just a couple, it's a lot, depending on what is happening in the market. What is done by companies which manage people's money is that at the close of business every day, they do what is called mark-to-market. They look, now, versus in the morning when the market opened, have we made more money or gained? Have our bond gained value or lost value? But if you're the owner of the money, you don't get told this every day. You will suffer a stroke if you get told this. You spend this. And at regular intervals, agreed with the person who's managing your money in terms of the money, they tell you, on a market, you set them performance target for the year. Usually, they are against the index. You know, it can be emerging market bond index or whatever case may be. But you set them this target. They tell you what has happened and so on. And the durations in between, you don't care too much about. Don't get me wrong. When there is a crisis in a particular jurisdiction and you know that your money is there, it doesn't have to pick up a phone and say, I'm hoping that you're making the right move so that we don't have massive losses. You know, but you leave to them because you don't want to direct them, because if you say to them, move the money out, and they lose, they will say, you remember the day you asked us to move the money? That's the day when we made the losses, so they are for your account, not for us. You know, those kinds of things. So I hope that this covers everything on the CRA. The fact that if there is no contingent liability, all we have done is to make a commitment that we will take our reserves from where they are and lend them to one of the five countries at that time. Up front, we have made a commitment what the maximum amount that we would make available is. They too have made commitment how much they would give to us. And I made the point the other day, it's written in the agreement of Treaty Annual. We, in our case, benefit, we would get double the amount we put in. So the multiplier, when you apply the multiplier for South Africa, we would take about 21% of the reserve pool, whereas our contribution is 11%. Right? Now, if the benefit is not clear, then my head has got a problem. I mean, so that's where the thing stands. In addition to the announcement, I've taken a lot of time to explain, so I wanted us to understand. Let me get now to the NDP. The issue with the NDP is the NDP. Two, we make upfront commitment, paid in capital $2 billion, 24 billion rand if you use yesterday's exchange rate. Can go up or down when the currency moves. Payable over 7 years, small in the initial years, getting larger in the outer years, makes it manageable. it's important to note that this is an investment. Although we respect it as a spending in our books, it is money that leaves our books. But if we're doing a balance sheet as government, like businesses would do, we would reflect today it is, let's say, cash that we have as an asset. But tomorrow it will show assets in this bank. And over time, if the bank is well run, the value of that asset will expand. If it's badly run, of course, which is a possibility, the value of the asset shrinks. If it is very, very badly run, just that it closes the doors one day, you can write the amount off. But how many Madrasal Development Banks have closed their doors since the Bretton Woods institutions were established? To my recollection, none, but I don't read everything. Right? So I wouldn't understand why we would take such a dim view of our capabilities and the capabilities of our people. That in our case, this one that we set up is going to destroy value rather than create. So my view is that it's a worthwhile investment. Worthwhile because the value of our assets will grow. Of course, I was very transparent on the day to make the point that, look, these things never pay dividends, so you never take the money out of it. It just actually in there and grows and grows. Yes, it means that South Africa, and indeed Africa, will have now access to yet another pool of savings from these five countries, and possibly later on when it opens up to other members from those other countries too. I normally say to people, I like benefiting personally, and I like to see South Africa benefit. But there is nothing bad with sometimes being part of something that helps our continent benefit. Now, you can take a narrow view and say, own affairs kind of stuff. But if you look at the investment that our companies make on the African continent, be it in telecommunications, retail, mining services, to name the things, investment into the continent outwards has doubled every 5 years since 2002. That year, the reference here may not be quite correct, but I think I am correct. Doubled every 5 years. If you look at dividend flows from the investment that South Africa has made, they are massive. Let me say this, in safety of this room. There are companies in South Africa whose growth is largely attributable to their footprint on the continent and here. A 50 million people market is nothing. It is nothing. Maybe I should say something, but it's a small something. Right? There is a billion population on this continent. So we must be there. The way we do with policy in ourselves, so that I understand my interpretation from the principle, is that we must be there to help the parts of Africa achieve that which on their own they may not be able to achieve. Because as Africa rises, as Africa does well, we stand a good chance of doing better. So we can't stand by and say we focus on ourselves. Someone else must help Africa rise. When it rises, we will reap the benefits. I think it would not be a kind of responsible stance. So in a way, we are in this for ourselves in the first instance, yes, but also for the continent. It is for this reason that then the focus on the of the regional strength would be on project development, which we have realized to be the biggest challenge for ourselves and the continent. Other parts of the world too, by the way. Developing good, bankable projects that once you put before a bank manager or a credit committee, they can only salivate and give you the money so that you get on with the business of implementing the project and then reap the benefits. Of course, there will be instances where there will be projects that go back. You would hope that the majority would do well. And remember, these are government projects predominantly. The good thing about government is that they never get liquidated and disappear. You may restructure the debt close to nothing, and then the government will still be there and rise again. I'm touching on several things. Those will be the benefits. Now, it is perhaps it's a bit awkward because the treaty almost suggests that once you ratify the treaty, you have made the commitment, you have kissed the thing goodbye. It's not quite like that. It's probably a little bit extreme. There is truth in it, but it's a little bit extreme the way they put it, because the money will have to be appropriated every year that it has to go. Now, with Parliament having the power to amend money bills, it will be foolhardy, I think is the term, for us to just assume that we'll come here and say you signed the treaty, so this billion is full now. You've got no choice. It's not quite like that. It would be embarrassing, of course, if you say no, no doubt, but you still have the right to say no. So the appropriation, it's unlike, say, a guarantee, which is where the use of a guarantee term is not appropriate here. Guarantees, by definition, are a direct charge against the National Revenue Fund. Once you've signed the guarantee, you can't then change your mind when there is a call. Here you can, at least legally. It may be something else politically and reputationally. Now, that's a different matter, but the law is on your side. I will be quick on the other thing. Following lending rates, they are not known. The principle, though, is simply this. This bank will lend on commercial terms. So for each one of the borrowers, the risk associated with lending to them, first, as by virtue of their credit rating, by virtue of their record of servicing their debt with the IMF, World Bank, IFTB, AFTB, whoever else, the risk associated with lending with them to them will be priced or reflected in the price. Suppose there is sometimes a tension between being developmental and pricing the risk in, but it's the nature of business. Because if you do the opposite, you can create all manner of distortions would undermine the sustainability of the institution. These laws or treaties and everything are meant to actually protect the money of the lenders. By the way, Honorable Chair, the amounts committed in callable capital and whatever else in relation to this bank are in no way, shape or form, different from those relating to the World Bank, IMF, DBSA, everything. They are exactly the same. So the trouble people have with this one should be the trouble they have with those institutions, if I may say. Otherwise, it would be kind of a double or triple standard. It's exactly the same way. That doesn't mean that they are not having financial or fiscal implications. I've described it, the 24 billion, it will have to be passed every time in law, and so on and so forth. I'm close to ending that. I'll respond. I still have left now. Oh, they're behind me. I threw them last. Look, the last question about other costs, because 24 billion covers the capital contribution. Most of the financing of the operations of the bank would be from the interest on the amount that we invest. But there are some initial setup costs. I alluded to this. We are, for instance, required to nominate a vice president, nominate a group of technical people to be seconded there. They will have to be taken care of from the point of view of salaries, accommodation, travel, incidental, and stuff like that. We have agreed as the members of the BRICS countries. When I say we, not in my personal capacity, just now people feel it's now becoming egotist. But I'm just saying, the countries have agreed that, look, let's make some contribution to this. So once the treaty is passed, then it will be possible for us to make it. They are not going to be. For instance, there is a come off line from a budget of the Treasury through reprioritization. But then we report at the end of the financial year. We will be transparent. I can make this undertaking to tell you, you know, of that amount on our international financial relations budget, international relations and economic policy, right? Budget X went to this. We wouldn't have that. We owe you that. I mean, we can't. There will be those costs. There may also be costs. In fact, let me say there will be costs associated with setting up ARC here. The not the African Research Center. we made promises when we were bidding. That's how you win these things. We may have to pay their rent, rate, or something like that. But it's manageable, not astronomical cost. Good things cost some money most of the time. And we'll disclose these things as and when we are required. Our CAL colleagues, they make very, very valid, call them important points about the need to make sure that this bank goes about its business in a responsible way. It must be democratic, inclusive in how it takes decisions, and so on. But we can lobby for some of these things to be part of the policies of the MDB. Now, we will lobby. It's not going to be too hard. By the way, some of the criticisms they were leveling against the IMF and World Bank, predominantly World Bank, unfair to the World Bank, to be honest with you. I'm not their biggest fan, but I also wouldn't want us to accuse them of things that they don't do. It wouldn't be right. The World Bank, I think the loan to Eskom for a coal-fired power station may have been the last they ever made for a coal-fired power station. Now, let's think about this. When we get the World Bank, one of the sides from developing slowly emerging market countries is that your insistence as advanced countries on now clean technologies, which tends to be generally expensive now, right, is not helping us. You developed on the back of dirty energy, and now today you say, no, let's not pollute, when in our case we still have a development deficit. I'm not arguing, by the way, that we should pollute. I'm just saying the debate that takes place at the table with our friends is the tension where people say, don't come and talk to us clean energy. After now, you have achieved immeasurable levels of development if you are down there. You know? So we would have to approach this with a lot of care. It's important to do things in a responsible way, in an environmentally sustainable way, but find the right balance between the goals that are competing. But the commitment we can make is that we would, at every opportunity, do the lobbying that's necessary to make sure that this brings up business rightly. It involves people. It has got mechanisms to deal with the negative impact where some of these slip through those processes. We also, I want to be very, very honest and frank with you. We are one of five countries. If you measure us in terms of many things, the smallest, the only thing that I think we rank highly is the per capita GDP or GNP. Right? We rank as high, we're close at the top among those countries. But generally on other things, we're not quite up there. We were the last to join the BRICS. We requested to be in, whereas the others agreed first to be established members. Now, I say these things to you so that as we grow together, you understand the power dynamics in the forum. You don't walk in last and read the toughest rules to the rest of the people. Because they might just say, you know, before you were here, without using those words, they might just say, you know, in 20-something, we used to move very fast on this subject, but these days we seem to be too slow. This is what you stand by the way. And the old days, yeah, so it's not a downgrade, we will not pass about our way. One of the things, though, I mean, and think about this, because I would assume that you've got a way of working with other international groups like yourself, is that there is nothing that what, let me restate that. You can approach the point of trying to make sure that this bank goes about its business in the right way by influencing the bank on your side, but you can also very effectively influence it by going to the countries that will be borrowing to make sure that their own legal frameworks are supportive of the goals that you want to achieve. The latter is more elegant than the former. A bank that comes to a country and says, put aside the sovereignty, your policies, your laws and stuff like that. Now we're here with the money. The rules are ABC. It usually runs into trouble. Because if you use money to almost all of a sudden impose policies and how countries must run their business, you have a problem. Whereas the other one works better because you say to the country, it is in your interest as a country to have good policies that protect your own people, and mitigate the risk associated with and stuff like that. So they do things for themselves because it is in their own interest, not external interest to go about the stuff. So it's a very important thing. But we have heard you. We will send you the formal response if we haven't sent it yet. There are things that I've said here, I've taken the liberty to say here, which I wouldn't say in writing, but just read them to be implied. But for now, Chair, if I may now really conclude, the key is let's be part of the BRICS by, if we can, ratifying the agreement which three countries have already ratified. So the scope to change things is almost zero. Once we pass that, then let's look at the other avenues where we can influence things and achieve our objectives. Thank you very much. I've taken long, but I thought I should be.
That's fine. I'd suggest that we, if necessary, spill over slightly for 1 o'clock, because of the nature of the issue. For past one. So we have got plenty of time. The same thing to say, a lot of times I ask is that why we allow this latitude is because some of the things you say are not relevant to the NDB. But it serves like an education thing. The insight we draw from what all of you have said, we can use in processing other policies and those that come before us. Having said that, I thought Tandi, Makosi, Michelini, Dave, for now, in that order, and then Dave.
Thank you, Chair.
Can I also please, given that there are two committees here, that we try to keep maximum 5 minutes a person?
Sure. Let me thank you. My gearbox is not functioning well, so I will not be the usual David advocate. Because as the gearbox is going left, I can't just feel that my last one. I can't just feel that my last one. So I'll be a little bit nice today. But Chairman, let me thank you. Thank you for allowing, when we made the request, to allow other people to make presentations, to allow that to happen. Because some of us learn, and I believe we'll learn until we die. We get more informed. And by so saying, I want to say that actually I'll be pleased if the FFC provides us with more documentation to inform us, because we learn through this process. And on a lighter note, Chair, I thought that the proximity of finance to trade developed automatic diplomats in government officials, because sometimes it's the language that helps to bring people closer together. The Chinese are experts of that. They invite opposition party members to their policy debates. And by the time they take a policy decision, there's no qualm. So I also learned as a feminist that there's a difference between how women tend to articulate I'm not one of those. Women are softer and they can use softer language and it makes peace for everybody. I leave it like that. But one day we'll talk about, and I know my next friend, my host, will not leave it at that definition. So let me go to the issue. One, I'm interested to know the work of the CLA in terms of educating people to understand their basic human rights, to participate. Because rights also goes with responsibility and knowledge. So that when communities participate in decisions about projects that will take place in their localities, they themselves are well informed, so that they do not take ill-informed decisions either to reject or to accept projects. I'll be interested in what they do, but I'll leave it at that. The issue that I wanted to do, because I don't want to go back to the questions I asked last week. When I was listening to the presenters, one question came to my mind. that how do you quantify cost benefits not quantifiable in the current conjuncture in terms of the project that we are about to undertake? And don't misinterpret the question. The question doesn't say relook the agreement. It says how will you quantify the cost benefits. And it doesn't say tease out the entire project in terms of how you're going to fund it, in terms of the contingency reserve. It does not talk to that. It just says that we need to be able to have something in hand so that when we lay oversight as committee of parliament, when we come here and ask you about the contingency reserve, what qualifications will have we had before, and how will we juxtapose it to our monitoring you if there isn't no form of presentations that has been made? I don't know whether you get a teaching. It says give us something so that when we really look into this, then there's something that we will have said we want to. Now, the SSCs say that there's no compelling reason for equity funding, especially the children that must be payable to the ending license. Very interesting action. I thought the DG would zoom into that. If they say that there's no compelling reason for equity funding of the 2 billion. And then they make a proposal. They say that you see, that's the problem, Chair. They speak 6 minutes, and then Robbie has 5 minutes, you know? And
we have 2 minutes in here, Sandy, but not 6 minutes.
That's very difficult. No, thank you. Okay, thank you.
How many minutes do you want, and how long are you prepared to stay?
Sure.
Okay. Is anybody wanting more than 5 minutes? Let's do by consensus, okay? Who wants more than 5 minutes? 5 minutes?
Okay. I got it. I'm not going to take 5 minutes. I might give some of my minutes back to 20. No, Chair, first of all, let me thank Carl and FFC and TPO. And to me, honestly, I think it's very important that we get these different perspectives. Though I must say that DG, at some stage, I was getting a feeling that you were elevating yourself to a financial omnipotent, looking down upon some fiscal collective stupidity here. That's the thing I was getting, but not that I was not understanding what you were saying. I think it's very important that when we are raising, when issues are being raised, let's rather tackle them in a very constructive spirit, because some of us, we are here, whatever TPO is saying, whatever FFC is saying, especially on the issue of the contingency liability, I think to me it's important that we get the other side of the story. It's important for us to understand what are the cost benefits that are there, what are the risks, and we are not just here to rubber stamp. We are not here to rubber stamp, we are here to perform, to exercise, you know, effective fiscal oversight. And the most important thing for us is that we need to understand these issues. And we understand that to deal with these issues on a daily basis, hence these sessions are going to be coming to you, because we expect answers. But we don't want to be patronized in the process. That we don't like as members. I don't think I do. Personally, I don't like it. Anyway, that's beside the point. The point that I wanted to take from FFC, especially around the issues of cost benefit, you know, and probably even from the DD, they will have to be assisting us with that. Now, there is a bigger picture here. We deal with these issues within a context where, and probably even Carl as well, because these are some of their concerns. Obviously, because the benefit that we are going to be getting is because of our positioning and so forth. And one of the questions that we asked the last time was that we wanted to get something concrete about what is the, you know, what is the what is, what are they, is going to be a differential treatment of us as member countries, and what are we going to be benefiting tangibly. We understand that there will be no dividend to explain, but we understand that. And obviously, we wanted to know whether if a project is coming from South Africa, is there going to be a different way of looking at it, or, you know, the commercial rule that applies to everybody else is going to be applied. I think that is going to be important for us to know. But one of the things that is a major concern is that given the fact that, you know, direct foreign investment, you cited it as one of the core benefits FFC, but the reality of the situation is that we are now living in a very high-tech society, a very digitalized economy, and even CAR as well, they put only their major concern in terms of beneficiation, they were looking more at jobs. And to me, I'm not sure if jobs is really the leading that we should be looking at if we are talking about the benefits of the local communities. Because sometimes, whatever that is, that investment that is coming there, it's not coming with any job. If for all you care, it could come and create only 3 jobs, all everything else is going to be done by robots. So, and at the same time, you are also experiencing the affected. I mean, individual taxpayers are beginning to feel the pinch. The reality of tax-based erosion as a result of transfer pricing and whatnot is a reality. And the reality is that when we look at these things, and the reason why we are very interested in actually understanding in detail what is the cost benefit, it is because we wanted to be able to to position ourselves in the kind of environment that we find ourselves. Probably what IMF and World Bank, when they came up with their policies previously, it was not the same environment as now. The environment that we are coming in, the whole game has changed completely. So it's not as easy as that. And I also wanted to say to them, on the other hand, I think it's going to be important that as much as, and I wanted to agree with the DG there, that South Africa is a small party, we came last, it's going to be very important to impose ourselves. But the other thing that is also important is that we must not constrain ourselves. We know the risk. I mean, we want development in Africa, but we also have to be honest about some of the risks that are there. We may actually even have to impose certain things that we say, you need to have a democratic process. You need to, you know, those type of things that are actually the roots of a cause of civil wars, and that will create, you know, a risk on our investment, those type of things. So when we are talking about, you know, we shouldn't be imposing, we are not necessarily extending that to those things that are going to be exposing us to further extension.
We'll come back if there's more time, but each person gets up to 5 minutes. Yes, thank you. I mean, so is it David next? Oh, yes.
You know, the two colleagues have covered quite, you know, a few things that I was asked. You know, DG, as you were, you know, putting your presentation here, you covered quite a few things. And, you know, after the presentation by my two sisters over there, I had more than 5 questions. But as you alluded to, you covered quite a few things. I think mine's going to be less than a minute. You know, just before you ended your presentation, you sounded like a heartfelt, you know, with the World Bank, if I may give an example, if this could be a proper word to use. I just want to know if, you know, when these institutions, they identify projects that, you know, they come and they do, or they fund, or direct a grant to, I just want to know that how do you also get involved in such corrections yourself as an institution? Because, you know, I realize that, you know, some of the projects that, you know, we receive as a country, they sometimes go beyond, you know, the duration. Let us say, for example, they say Project X is going to take about 3 years. You find out it goes beyond 5 years. So I just want to know what could be the reason. Are you seriously monitoring this project? or just because you are not part of those that are funding those projects, you happen to be far away, are you involved or you are not involved? And maybe I may also be interested to know, in some of these projects that you took part in whatever arrangement of direction, which ones are the worst? You may be able to give a list of those projects that your institution is monitoring on a day to day, or you are still planning to monitor those institutions or projects. I have you give an example of World Bank funding one of the power stations. I think it has made a lot of noise, from the community cycles. That's why I'm putting some of these questions to you. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you for a very good presentation by FSC Treasury. I really appreciate that. Just with regards to the important issue of ratification, do we have a deadline in terms of when we should ratify the agreement? Firstly, and then also with regards to ratification, should we also consider the macroeconomic circumstances of each country, noting that Russia, Brazil, and China, South Africa, the growth has stalled, that we have very low growth rate in those countries on macro, and that India is a little bit of a beacon of light. How do you view this in terms of the global situation, the macro situation, and whether that will have an impact in terms of sustainability of the bank? Do you think that should be considered before ratifying the agreement? But then with regard to the operating capital of $100 billion, which would be equally shared among surrounding members, we only have subscribed capital now of $50 billion. The $100 billion, was that initially set as a viability measure to ensure that we get to that huge amount, to ensure that the bank is viable? And currently we only have 50%, which is the subscribed capital that will be paid in a callable component. Now the subscribed capital for South Africa is $10 billion, and we know that has not been budgeted for. And it will be in 7 installments, if I'm correct. Only $2 billion of $10 billion is covered in the installment schedule. So that poses a risk for us in terms of those installments. As you say, it will be smaller in the beginning, leading up to more later on. But in the coming MTBPS, what will the effect be on the fiscus, and will it impact on service delivery with regard to that? And then the second component, the contingent reserve agreement. Currently our debt contingent liabilities included 57% of GDP. Now we're not, according to your presentation, going the contingent liability route, we're going a loan route to one country, you said, one of the 5 countries. Noting the growth constraints in those countries, is that the correct thing to do? And why are we not going the contingency reserve route? Is it because of the rating agencies that would find that our debt to GDP is going to increase substantially, that could impact on our loan ability, and also in terms of repayment that needs to be done in terms of increased repayment schedule. Thank you, Chair. I think that concludes my presentation.
Thank you, Chair. I think let me start by welcoming the 3 presentations. Four. If I could get a response of the DG. I think my first question was taken by, which is a question that we posed in our last presentation, the issue of budget provisions in the current budgeting cycle. And I think maybe the teacher will give more information on that. But then secondly, it's just to check what is considered, because we keep on hearing this challenge when the borrowing is denominated by foreign currency. What do you consider the national treasure to get the borrowing from abroad? Because as we spoke to the slide on the intergovernmental relations, it really shows that at the end of the day, I mean, it's national treasury that must okay some of these arrangements if provinces or municipalities want to undertake them. But lastly, just an observation, I find it very interesting to the composition of the teams that are presented to the committee today, and also what is it that they presented. It was really looking to the first presentation, obviously driven by 2 young ladies, more concerned about human rights and issues of nature conservation. Trying to tell you that we are more concerned of the future. If we buy it today, we do whatever today, think of our future. And the second observation is about the analogy of the horse and the cow. The donkey and the cow. I think that analogy has been confirmed through the two presentations. So the other side is like more cautious and being pessimistic. The other side is more optimistic and very defensive, you know. But I think from where I'm sitting, they finally agree that the other side is a car market is a donkey. So I think all of them are committed as to how we use the information they have provided, I mean, to our work. But all in all, I think the points made came up very, very sharply. And from where I am, I think I'm more informed as to some of the dynamics around this process. And I'm more than ready, I mean, to engage the BD itself. Thank you very much.
Any other issues? So now, before the chairs come in, Tari and Makosi, you were unhappy, you've got more time now. You can have another 3 minutes or so.
No. I want to be here too. No, sir, it's just one last issue, but I believe maybe because the other thing.
Huh? It is on.
It is on. The last issue, which I wanted to know, because remember I asked the question when I was not here, when the FFC was saying that the funds should come from the national share. I thought the DG was going to respond specifically to that and look at when he said there should be a provision for the liabilities. I know that today we don't want to discuss everything, but just No, I was saying when the DG responds to that, to look at that. One last issue, which I believe it's a matter of engagement. When you undertake to have a development bank, it's a fact that you just pose it against the current financial institutions that seek not to address the matter that we want to be addressed. You take it with a pinch of salt when you say it's because you don't have an intention to launch an ideological bet, but we have that. We have the responsibility to say that we were not happy with how financial institutions like IMF, for instance, have funded projects, putting conditionalities that we have to set us, especially in the Gulf. So this intention was to actually counter that, to say we'll put a mechanism in the framework that will suit us. But even when we transact, because this is a transaction, the financial implications for each and every country, the timing of that, the reserve you have, the denomination, and I'm careful when I want to engage on the issues of the denomination, because the gist of the matter is not about the denomination, but the final implication of the denomination is when it's not the same. The currency exchange rate is not the same. So looking to it forward, TG, the implication on our reserves in terms of the denomination is a matter that we want to look into, so that when we transact. And I'm interested, I keep on going back to this thing. Why is the FFC saying that there is no compelling reason for it, for this equitable share? Why? What informs that position? Can we probe into that and look at that? Because to me, it becomes very interesting, especially when we need to make this reflection now. At any point when it's called upon for us to make it, anytime, it's going to change how we have set up the estimate of personal expenditure and current consumption. And if you say that, and is having an implication or not. And it's, so why not basically saying, because going this mad into the question, if I say that because we are in the interest of guarding the press, it's not the other way around. So it will be inherent in our nature when we ask those questions, because we will have to, at some point, to allay the fears of every boot in our conduct. So don't read much into it. So, ideologically, we're on the right track. We are agreeing with that. we are not even retreating in any way, but we want to be financially on the careful side and then be doing them in the right way so that tomorrow we don't come back and then we take a decision. We took a decision, but you cannot explain it in one way or another. I think I'm a little bit clear on that. Perfect.
Okay, I wanted to say, you know, on slide 9 and 10, I don't know if the DDA has from SFP, if you could respond to this, because they are actually arguing a perspective that are probably calling for national treasury to respond on the question of equity and the contingency liability. And they are also even suggesting that if we go a different route, there may actually be a need for a legislative, you know, a legislative process that might be there. So I think that's something that it will be of interest to the committee. If you could just respond to those, thank you.
Okay, thank you. I believe the DG elaborated furthermore on the last page of the presentation that was done to the Select Committee on Finance 2 weeks ago, referring to your input today. That's why our members have been silent in terms of the questions without the pen. It will be important, and it's a fact that these two committees will do the monitoring and oversight over the NDP. And we will have to look at a monitoring tool, because we will have to create one. In terms of the question that has been asked here, that will form the framework of that. So dealing with this ratification, our committee will meet on the 3rd of June, it's next Wednesday, when we will take this forward. Thank you, sir.
So a few things. One is, I think there must be clarity that nobody is saying no to the NDP. We're just raising issues around the implications for and for the development issues in our country and political issues, right? On the issue of CALS, let me speak for a tip. You know, in the 1980s, I was exactly where you were. I'm not interested in you, but let me put my position. In terms of ideas, there's very little you say that I would disagree with. This is not the position of the ANC. I have the right also to bouncing things off. And I can't go to study groups and ask them for consensus and for minimal institution. So let me say, personally, the values that you express are consistent with the traditional ANC, the liberation movement, and the UDF structure that I learned in the 80s. There's very little you disagree with. I'm very glad, let me tell you, that you are here. This is your parliament, your civil society, and Parliament needs to incorporate you even more than we've ever done. So, you know, I think it's great that you came forward with the thing. I'm also not convinced that the DG is at his best today, to be quite frank. His reply may have a slip to the question that you raised. I think, firstly, that one would like... let me say, I think most of our country fathers, at least I agree, that you can't punch above your weight. You know, I'm very sympathetic to what you're saying, Gigi. And I also think that looking at the 5 or 4 other countries and the political culture and values of those countries, some of them at least, certainly 2 of them, it can be extremely challenging in the international terrain. All of which I think one can be very sympathetic with, but yet at the same time say that what CALS is saying needs to be taken more seriously. It's for the committee to apply its mind over time. But what they are saying is basic, like, it's part of our constitution, it's part of our culture, political culture of the majority party, fading as that culture is today. But the traditional values of the movement and what they are saying, I can't see any difference. I can't see any difference. Even in government, we have to be pragmatic. How do we conform to those values? That's the issue for him. And I don't think that you, with due respect to you, you're showing such insensitivity to that. That's my personal view. So the question that I would like to, I think the committee has a right to see. I understand you can't put down on paper what you said, but at least a more concrete response to the proposals that the members need to apply their minds to this. The first question I want to ask is, what exactly is the liquid human rights, if you like, culture of the NDP? Is there anything in founding principles about these. Now, I understand that China is where it is, right? Russia is where it is. I can say that as a politician. I'm a politician. Those of you who watch House of Cards, and I think you should. We've been watching the Russians. It's based on a certain Russian president. And yesterday's, last night's thing was really very, 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 very good to see. So I just want to say certain things. I feel that actually what Charles is saying, the three proposals they've got at the end, go too far in my view. There's something they ask for. Ideally, yes. In the current world, no. Let's start with your three proposals. Like you say, put a policy in place that takes account of the first four things. I think in some other transition form, the committee needs to apply a fine. That when we monitor, we're not just going to monitor in fiscal terms, but also the nature of the projects that have been funded, the values underpin them and so on. And I think this is a useful guide. It goes too far. But there's a germ of value in what is being said here. Otherwise, we're going to be on the IMF and World Bank. Secondly, encourage the trade to insist on the grievance. Ideally, yes. But I don't think it's going to happen for a long time to come. But they need to apply to that. More than you've offered here, and maybe there wasn't time. They need to apply their right to a reply. This committee might want to think about in what form, over time, we want to consider the second thing. I'm saying we must consider it. I'm not saying I don't have an answer. But to me, personally, if I had the power, and I don't, you could see the study group, obviously, right? I am there like little service, right? But in any case, what I'm saying is, comrades, let's look at where we were and where we are. What's wrong with that thing? It can't be done. It's not doable. But you know what? I have a problem with my daughter. She confronts me and she says, Dad, why are there no libraries in every school? She's an equal education, right? I said, I had a speak up. So right. I was there in the 1980s. You are right from your perspective. A library in every school. I am right as an aide, I was then a minister, as a deputy minister at the time. Deputy minister of government say it's not doable. But hey, continue. As far as I'm concerned, you're very important. Don't give up. Much in the streets if you want to. That's your right. Don't burn down any buildings and don't steal from the vendors, but march. So as far as I'm concerned, you're right. Except it's not doable in the real world that we live in. Okay? It's not in the real world that we live in. So as far as your values and concerned, both of us in the AC at least and many other parties will agree. On mediation, I mean, I agree. It's not doable in agency. But what I'm saying is this committee needs to apply its mind by next week in our report. Will we put a gentle thing in? I'm not saying we take a discussion. I'm telling you to think about it. Gentle thing that says, we heard Charles. The values that Charles underpin, I'd like to suggest Ellen and Estelle and Tumasani and Sean, think about this draft, right? That the members can apply their minds. In our report, we say something like, probably we agree with the values, but we do not think that they are doable in the context that the TG set out. Now, we can find the right word in that. And that over time, the things that you have said, we will, in a phased and appropriate manner, insert it into our monitoring tool, as you said. So that's what I want to say on that issue of things. The second set of issues are the FSCs. Now, the teaching of value for some of us is that while the FSC might have gotten slightly wrong here and there, the insertion of these issues helps us because it broadens our technical understanding of issues. So even if they've got it wrong, I think it's a value, at least to me, hopefully many other members. The third point to ask is, I don't exactly know personally, Advocate Jacob, what exactly is the FSC's role in regard to this? Yeah? If it does have a role, the question that arises is, why can government not consult with the FSC? Or at least brief them on what's happening? The fact that you suggest, DG, that you are so far apart in understanding, even using the analogy of the donkey and the what is it, the horse, the cow, it's not your problem, the National Treasury. Did you consult with them if it's appropriate? I'm not sure. And you know, or confer with them, or even tell them, look, it's not your area, but let's brief you. It's a big issue with NDP. Then there's a lot of other things I want to say, but I want to round up because time's running out. I want to say the following things, colleagues. This thing about DG saying that, you know what, you have power the Money Bills Act to an end and so on. It's true, not true. The reality is that the Money Bills Act has never been used, am I right, up to today to amend anybody. And there are complex political and other issues that made it possible that if Parliament grows in strength again, as it was in 1994, in the first 5 years, we will probably do that. We will in fact do that. It's high time, frankly,
that the money was actually used. Why has Parliament never used it in all these years? Right. Now, what I'm saying is, I agree with those who suggest it. And I also sympathize with you. You're human, you're irritated, and there's nothing to apologize for. I think you're human. But there's a tone, I know you quite well now, and it's not a typical DG that I know. I think you, especially maybe with FSC, a bit with PDO, a bit with health, a bit with the committee, you came here and you told us, I agree with what Cody said, and to some extent I think Sandy, that, you know what, we're not going to apologize, DG. You are technically far more, okay, I've been in this movement for 40 years now, right? But you are technically far more efficient and equipped to deal with issues than I am, forget the others. And it's not fair to imagine that, you know, you can get irritated, but at a human level, hey, I think it's fine. I have no problems with your irritation. Right? But I think you have to be fair to us that, you know, the members hit me very hard last week. They denied, they said, raise it when you were here. I teasingly told them, no. Actually, there are very few questions were raised. And not all of them have been answered. And in fact, I agree with Makoti and Tandi a lot more than they might think. And I want to say that, you know what, we have to now bring things to a closure by next week on this cost side, because we've got problems about inserting it into the National Assembly as soon as the first scenario occurs. So how do we go forward? Can members apply their mind? I think there are many unsettling, unsettled issues. What I would like to say, in fairness to everybody, which is why I try to control the time, we should give health a few minutes, 3 to 5 maximum, and FSC 3 to 5, and PDO 1 to 2 minutes, because you're in-house, and then the DG is in class, right? But the question I want to ask, I want to suggest to the committee, is that we ask the Secretariat and the PDO to pull together these thoughts, draw up a report, right, that we hold this week, but that we consider, and we have questions that are, let's say, still occupying us. Then let's not vote on Tuesday. Let's take a debate forward on Tuesday and vote on Wednesday. Maybe that's a safer route to go. It's not about saying no, obviously we're not going to say no. It's about Parliament playing its role. And you should be actually encouraged by people being obsessed, maybe, and even getting nitpicky and even petty about the use of the budget that you and the custodians are with us, right? So I think that what members have asked have been very, very good. I think the FSC also agrees with you partly. I think they've got it wrong here and there. And fine, no problem, because we've learned other things from the input. So, and I think Carol's has been super. And I think EBO's been excellent. So I really think it's been a useful exchange. I don't think we need to rush to voting, because what I did, the first penalty we can have is after the ninth, right? Is that right? Because there are no plenaries that we can insert. There's going to be debate, presumably. Can you help us on the deadline?
Yeah, no. Also, to come to an appropriate determination, I think it will be important just to check from the technical side what is at stake by prolonging this process, you know. Yeah. I think it's very important.
Yeah. Maybe I'm not clear enough. We are, whatever happens, going to vote on this thing. Immediately, the first plenary after the budget is adopted on the 9th, right? Mm-hmm. The budget adopted on the 9th, am I correct? Okay.
Yeah.
Yes, it is the 9th. So, on the 10th, we should try to insert this thing into the House. So let's work backwards, right? What's next week? No, we can actually, can I suggest something? That we bring everybody together. We're not expecting you to be here. Tie up the outstanding issues on Tuesday, vote on it on Wednesday, and put it to the House on the first sitting day of the plenary at the 10th. How that? Any proposals in that regard? Agreed. Good. So that said, can we have help up to 5 minutes, and then if it's up to 5 minutes, we'll only go, and DBO 2 minutes, and then yourself, DD, and let's take it forward. Yeah. No. I had misunderstood. I thought everybody was going to speak, right? Because I don't have feeling. But they didn't think so. You got your full minute. 5 minutes this time is the way we manage the MCs, right? 5 minutes. You can't get angry like them, okay?
We won't. When it comes to the question of recognition of benefits, do we see coming to community members for projects that have been financed by the entity? We definitely agree it has to go beyond jobs. ultimately the projects that are financed by NGB have to be developmental in nature. It itself says that it's for infrastructural and sustainable development. So benefit goes beyond that to socioeconomic benefits or development rather, and includes things like healthcare, education, water, sanitation, housing. Those are what we perceive to be developmental projects that the NGB should aspire for and do the beyond jobs. When it comes to the grievance mechanism, I have to disagree with that. The World Bank itself already has a grievance mechanism. It has the compliance of the Ombudsman. A variety of different banks around the world that provide development finance also have grievance mechanisms. The Southern African Development Bank itself has one. And European banks that provide development finance, commercial banks if you consider them to be, also do provide. and when it comes to the question about responsibility of rights holders, certainly one cannot speak about the human rights they have if they don't know they have them. So we definitely do take on educational projects. CALS as an institution has a number of them. We have the learning exchange, which provides learning exchange opportunities for different mind communities to learn from each other in the development of social and labor plans. We provide training before taking on litigious matters or communities to be able to hold their own agency in those matters. We're also involved in the people's treaty, which calls for sort of a binding treaty on business and human rights and have been involved in that. What we're also doing is actually a kind of training or an advocacy program with banks themselves. What we've learned is a lot of commercial banks actually provide development finance. And we've developed what we call draft handbook principles and are getting commercial banks to sign on to them that provide actual practices that can be taken on during a project's existence before it's put in place, during its operation, after, to ensure human rights compliance.
What do you think is doable from the proposals you are offering, bearing in mind what the DG says, that you know, it's not as if we can take on those giants and change the culture overnight? What do you think is doable?
But I think it's doable, at least at the very beginning, is to put in place a policy for lending, right? You need one anyway. That policy shouldn't be limited just to financial considerations, but it shouldn't be socioeconomic ones as well. And I definitely think grievance mechanism is doable.
Thank you, Chairperson. I just want to respond to one question, Honorable Tobias. And I suppose it also speaks a bit to the donkey and cow. I think one has to actually take into consideration that in a PowerPoint presentation you can only say this much. If I actually say recommendation this, now I'm looking at this particular issue that talks to the there is no compelling reason why this equity funding should be a first charge on the revenue fund. Now, this is a conversation around where must this fit in. And ultimately, the last bullet point in that slide concludes that contributions reflect that into the normal budget process. So if we read that slide in its entirety, there is no contradiction with what the DG was saying or the point that you were making and what you said here. So I just want to clarify that. Now I want to put Professor Blackies and Dr. Mabu to respond to the other comments that were made. I'll call it the confession of the economic hitman. He is in the BRICS think tank, and he is in the FFC. It is just a
I didn't hear all the questions when I was about that point. Before me cleaning my cup, say I coffee because there's no utility here. But the long and the short of it, I think what's quite critical is that as a member of the BRICS think tank of South Africa, I would say that one of the most critical things that you need to remember is that the bank is just one of those output in a rubric of BRICS arrangement. Because you're interested in political governance, economic and political governance, that's the area that I'm involved in, the issues on social justice, and so on and so forth. But Africa is responsible for the social justice chapter, if you like, in a big arrangement. So my point is that it's not helpful to have this conversation, not see the total of the big configuration. Some founding statements come to the Fortaleza declaration, to the meetings going to happen June, July around these things, and also the configurations around the bank and the internal operations, the CRA. So there's a number of things that you correctly say that where certain parts of your parliamentary structure would have a window into, like for instance the one that is with international cooperation development, that there's other parts which you would have a window into in terms of financing. So it would be quite useful internal in terms of parliament, because I don't agree with all the stuff that the OBPFO has been saying last week and this week. But that's neither here nor there. So I would suggest that if you can also find internal in parliament between the South and the Chair to get a greater understanding about the different configurations and who looks at like windows of the fixed arrangement, it will provide greater understanding in terms of that. In fact, it will also address the issues that the colleagues have raised correctly. So, and it's been dealt with in another forum in terms of the multilateral nature of the BRICS configuration.
If I can just respond to Honorable Poser's comment on the cost-benefit analysis, and that the emphasis on jobs may be insufficient. We actually do agree with a sentiment. That's why, in our opinion, ultimately it's going to depend on the package of projects that are going to go through. Unfortunately, we don't know the overall package. The package could address other aspects beyond job creation aspects. So it's assisting and knowing the package of projects that are going to be financed where we run into a difficulty in quantifying the cost-benefit analysis. Then on the issue around our view that the greenest, well, the preference from our side was for it to be handled as a sort of contingency reserve arrangement. That's our view because we think that facility better responds to any unforeseen outcome. But as was explained here, the actual implementation is different from the contingency reserve arrangement. We didn't say the actual arrangement is contingency reserve element. We said, but what if all the menu of possibilities were available? Then our pick from the different menus would be to have it run through the contingency reserve fund. So just to clarify that point, that we did say it's going to run through the contingency fund arrangement, but rather that if we were to go a step back and say which arrangement are we going to use, our preference would have been for it to run through that arm of handling the arrangement.
Thanks, Chairperson, for a short comment. I think the input that the PBO made the last presentation in relation to public finances, in that presentation we emphasized that a lot of these cost and benefits are unfortunately impossible to quantify. I think the FSC has alluded to that in their presentation, and DG alluded to it as well. And necessarily, therefore, the process cannot be entirely precise when it comes to those things, and that is not unusual and not fine. I think the committee's role and the PBO's role in terms of guiding the committee relates in particular to public finances, and the committee is expected to oversee the fiscal framework. So it's natural one would ask questions about the possible implications of that. In the National Treasury presentation previously, they indicated that several options are being explored for funding, including larger requests for the upcoming 2015 NTES. And it may be that that's still a matter of consideration, and that can also be fine. But I think there there are potential implications of these arrangements both for the fiscus and for SAFCA's foreign exchange position. And we look to Treasury, who have the development expertise, to address that to the extent possible. And in the end, it's up to the, obviously the committee to satisfy themselves with that information. And that's really all that as we are, we're trying to draw attention to.
Over into you, DJ.
Thank you very much,
sir. Clarify for us, is there some principle around human rights and the sort of issue they raise? And then secondly, on the grievance mechanism, is there a proposal to have that, and is the one that IMF and World Bank having, or other, is it not something that's doable over time? I'm not saying it must be done immediately. You can also use Parliament as grievance to say the Parliamentary Committee raises it in our court and so on, and is concerned about it. But if you could answer those things, please.
Let me try and answer these things with the eloquence that I can muster. Of course, I do run the risk that I will offend people. I speak assertively, and I'm not sorry about it at all. No, I'm just saying, you know, I've got my voice and who I am. But I hope that the word I use and my body language does not demonstrate disrespect for people, especially parliamentarians. And I was not joking, by the way, Chair. I elected to be here instead of being at the AFDB out of respect for the committee and the work of Parliament. I could have left this with Andile. Right? I know. I elected to be here, that embassy. I prefer to talk the issues, not the person. And let me get to the issue. Perhaps I was too subtle. The first point I was making about about Carl's presentation was that the treaty is unlikely to be the vehicle through which the aspirations are expressing should find expression. The bank, once set up, will have to develop policy. Which loans does it fund? Under what conditions? What should it impose on stuff like that? But they don't belong with the treaty. They will, the time for them will come. Implied in what I was saying, and I wasn't dismissive at all of them. Just to say, the best vehicles for carrying or giving expression to what they want are yet to come. It is good, by the way, that they have raised these things now. Because they have raised that in our heads. As we interact with our counterparts, we'll say these kinds of concerns and so on and come up. Interestingly, the Honourable Member, we were saying, I'm careful with the World Bank. I was saying the debate between advanced countries and emerging countries. I was expressing the debate that these are the dilemmas, these are the tensions that people are facing. I was not going to hear South Africa or mine or, you know, just so that the, but I may have expressed the point compassionately and paid my facial expressions that you took. This is like a personal thing now. That's not the case. A very important point about how the governance arrangement works between shareholder countries and these kinds of institutions. You nominate an executive board member. They report to a board that's chaired. They work with the board that's chaired by the president of the bank. And then they report to the board of governors, which is the ministers of the country. So they kind of sign off on the policies and so on and so forth. But once you have set it up and you have the person, it is through that person that can influence things and so on. So we will, that's why it's very important for us to have make sure that whoever we nominate as our vice president, executive director, to be at the table when issues are discussed, policies, loans, applications for loans are considered, so that all the things that we have aspirations for can find expression in that, including the issue of the additionality or the impact of the project on the ground. Now, the question has arisen from Honorable Tandy about Honorable Tobias about
whether we can signal already how to measure this. I can understand what you want. It's difficult to say, but there are two kinds of impact that we can expect from the loan that a bank like this would issue. Maybe three. Number one, if South Africa applies, let's say, for a protein, you can work out, and there are ways technically to a cost-benefit kind of project appraisal. What are the likely cost and benefit directly of a particular project? And even indirectly of a particular project, South African. But it can also be done for a regional project. Let's say you find phase one or whatever of Kalinga, it would have direct and indirect. But it can also be kind of slightly more removed than indirect, which is the complication of something like this. Because if, for instance, a country that shares a border with us ultimately is able to borrow from this bank to build a railway line that connects that country to South Africa and then facilitate movement of bulk type commodities and whatever else, you again get the spin-off. Now, some of those would be very hard to measure because that would lift incomes in that country and may increase demand from that country for goods in South Africa and so on. So some of these questions I kind of don't want to dwell in them because, I mean, I say all of this, but those are the kind of things that we can look at. In other words, what's the impact in South Africa on South Africa people? What's the impact on our neighbors, the region? And what's the multiplier effect on the region and particularly South Africa that could derive from a particular project? And we can continually interact and talk on those. The biggest benefit for South Africa would derive either from loans that South Africa raises with the bank or loans that are to countries in the South region because of all of the things that I've just touched on now. The issue that Dr. Ramos goes back to again is about the why not use, say, the contingency reserve. When you look at the fiscal framework, right, before I get to the very direct answer to your question, when you look at the fiscal framework, the contingency reserve, we score it as if we're going to spend it. Right? Now, if we were to come and pay, let's set aside an amount on budget equivalent to our commitment to the CRA, which is like 5 billion. When you convert it to dollars, it's 50 billion. Right? To rand, sorry. It's 50 billion plus. And it may have to increase every day if the rand depreciates. You immediately show that South Africa's deficit is going to be higher by 50 billion. The reality is that you may never spend that 50 billion. So you present a bad picture of your country, that you are going to be borrowing more, and the pricing of our borrowing would reflect that, our credit rating and so on. I mean, it would be an ill-elegant way to think about how to finance this. And by the way, you set out an amount today, let's say you had set, we had set it when the rent was at 750. It's appreciated to take in and people are asking questions, when are you going to revise your deficit? Because now the amount you have set out, you see what I'm saying? So it's a very elegant way. Quite apart from that, though, what this is about pulling the reserves we have. We have them for the 50 billion. In assets, we are electing now to invest them in the places where we invest them. The alternative is to just say, yes, can a portion, which is 5 billion in this case, be used in the event it is needed. Now, this doesn't mean that it's lying idle now. What it does mean is that it is invested, but in short-term, highly liquid assets, so that when another country needs them, in a short space of time, we can liquidate the money and take it and give it to whoever needs it. Similarly, the other countries would probably have to do the same, be able to honor the thing. The point one was making on this, all the, was this, it is something, it's a run-of-the-mill kind of thing.
in other words, and I know this is where I got myself into trouble when I was preaching. It is happening every day. Every day we have disarmed through a committee that was set up with them, managing our reserves. They may employ for a portion of them banks or agencies to do this on their behalf on mandates that they prescribe for them. They do it every time. All that this does then is to just change that investment policy, include this thing, and therefore have it taken care of in terms of how they invest in themselves so that it can be accessible. So the point everyone was making on this chair was the laws that exist have allowed that to happen the way it's happening for all the reasons, good and bad, but good mostly. I can only think of good. It's happening that way. All that is introduced now is this element to say, let it be that we can put some in this country for this. The honourable member asked, we get involved. I've answered your question by saying our involvement is through the people we stand to represent us, and then they've got to play the role effectively there. The honourable Ross, only the CRA, it got no fiscal implications because normally the reserves are there. It's an asset. So it does not go through the fiscal framework or budget. It's a question of, are the assets in liquid form, cash, in dollars, euros, or some other currency? Are they invested in one jurisdiction two or three? So there are no fiscal implications there. Does that mean that there is no risk? No. I don't want to downplay it. If we were to give the reserves to a country and the country, let's say, goes very totally and has to restructure its debt as it happened with Greece, then in a way, that mark-to-market explanation I was giving would imply that first you take much down and ultimately it's written off. But the likelihood is very lean, as I was saying, because these are countries that want to keep a good relationship with us. There is no magic with the $100 number, but the kind of authorized capital wanted it to be sizable, that when you talk about it, people connect it to large impact type stuff. And of course, that's the one part of it, but the other part is you don't want people to be sitting around the table. You do 10 billion authorized capital, then you realize it's inadequate. You come back at it 2 years later, 3 years later. You want to sort of take some of the decisions once and for all and get down to just working with them. Honorable, that the budget implications of the commitment is yes, in fact, it was in the follow-up stuff. For the CRA, I've clarified nobody, but for the NDP, I'm transparent about this. It's 24 billion rand, or it's that put, by the way, 2 billion US dollars can be converted at a given time rand. The first installment is 150 million rand, 150 million US dollars. It's set out at the back of the document that I showed the other day. Just to be fine with Andy. It's a very transparent thing. It's 150, 250, 300, 300, 300, 350, 350. Right? US dollars. And every time, we will have, there are no other ways about it. We'll have to, as the president, apply through the budget process for an appropriation to us. We can be told to reprioritize within your budget or something like that to find the money for this. That will be the implication. And then it gets transferred. I was just thinking the technical part, Chair, where I said, you know, it's an appropriation. Because the suggestion, the insinuation of direct art is that we are bypassing Parliament and avoiding being accountable. And that's why one day it will come here. That you may not wish to change it or turn it down or whatever the case, but still it will come here. You know, like any other funding request. That's the point one was. Honorable Tobias, the funding should come from the national side. The FSC has raised this.
I must say, look, having worked with the vertical division of revenue, horizontal division of revenue all my life, it's almost academic that there is not having provisions there. Right? When the cake is cut at the start of every financial year, it cuts in a way that takes into account the expenditure responsibilities of each year. If they have increased, then it must commensurately increase. If they have decreased, it must commensurately decrease. You know, vice versa or stable. So, it will be reflected against the national fair. It may mean that the other fairs have shrunk. I mean, let's say it was a big amount. So there is no protection that you can really afford the other fair. But care to be taken that there is no impact on the kind of services that you have asked about the underlying reason for the establishment of this. I can only tell you, Honorable Tobias, what my principals tell me. Now, I can't read between the lines. I can't read between the lines. So, she understands me. But thank you very much, Chair. This is a very, very important point, coming to Carl's question again. You see, when we were thinking about this, as the technical team that was asked to do it, we said, look, it is going to arise who can be member, who cannot be member. Can we exclude countries that violate this or violate that? We said the easiest thing to do and convenient thing to do is to say countries must be members of the UN. And you would hope that as a community of nations, but it's written, by the way, in the treaty. It's in the treaty, you know. That country is not a member of the UN. So they behave in ways that get them excluded from the UN, then their membership of the bank will fall away. Now, we thought that was elegant because it's in a way it avoids that there is a standard for BRICS, there is a standard for UN, there is a standard for another structure. So that's in addition to, of course, seeing to it that the things that modern MDBs are doing to prevent wayward behaviors by the banks, which will have to be part of the process here, we'll look for it, gets done. That one is kind of the high order stuff to make sure that countries that are categorized badly by the international community don't belong. We thought that was an elegant way to deal with this thing. Thank you very much, sir.
But what did you say about the grievance procedure mechanism? Yeah.
I think that things like the grievance procedure, things like whether we fund coal-fired power stations, things that are not involved, those are going to be part of the policies of the bank, which our people, when they go, we will tell them, look, see to it that these kinds of things are part of the way this bank goes about its business. And we'll lobby hard to try and help them. And the point, by the way, that I was making about the World Bank was twofold at one stage. One, let's not accuse them because they're not in the room of things they are no longer doing. The second one was, it's kind of like everyone moves towards making sure that there is environmental sustainability in their products, which protects the people and so on. So it would be anomalous for this bank to say, we don't care about those things. In fact, it would work against it, I think.
It's only if there are things you discuss in the diplomatic halls that you will be occupied. You can't share with us, but we will monitor. We have been campaigning on these issues. Can I also say that, is there like a BRICS parliamentary forum? Because there should be one that holds the government to account. There isn't such a commission.
There isn't. What does happen, and it's not a... when there is a summit, different countries are left at liberty, in other words, the holder of the summit to pay, to have an outreach program, different from what you're asking. They do to use it differently. So there would be sessions where South African government, business, and so on, community are in a room. They can discuss issues, raise them. Then there would be a forum where then they make it outreach beyond that. For instance, South Africa chose to use ours in Durban to invite presidents from SADC, and there was something with them in Durban. The chair of the AU was there, just to say, look,
how can, what can FADC and Africa get from BRICS? And it is good for the presidents of the BRICS countries to hear from presidents of, say, FADC, as it was the case in the case, what their ambitions are between is for the continent and how the BRICS can fit into that and so on. But I can assure you, if you were to raise this with Minister Nkwane Maite Mashabane and Minister Mene and others, they would certainly take it into account, say, to influence Russia, but their plan may be too advanced. But certainly, when the next round for the summit comes, when our turn to host comes, because one of the things that I've observed is that countries can influence others in forums like this very positively. If you do something and it works well, others want to copy. Brazil, for instance, did something very similar to what we did with the South American countries and so on.
It's been a network on the World Bank and IMF, but it's a bit of a, let's put it this way, mild organization. So what we might want to do now, report to Parliament, we can find the appropriate wording, that the committee feels some consideration should be given in due course to the creation of a BRICS parliamentary forum, something like that, which doesn't bind anything. It's something that in a year or two or three, you know, people might pick up on. Okay? Then, having said that, we need to round up, but I must say there's a stranger in the house. We have Peter Paul in Dele, for those of you who remember him. I think I should let you know he was our committee secretary, and then we loaned him, without our permission, of course, to another committee, and they've stolen him. So there's a huge fight taking place over the matter, and we're bringing in the UN Secretary General to sort this out, for those of you wanting a report. We tried what was on Zoom at Zoom, and it hasn't worked, so now we go to the UN. Okay, having said that, you round up, but let me just say that, as I understand the process, why don't we summarize like this, that what we would do is ask Cleo and the Secretary to draft something by Friday afternoon. Then I will send it out to the members. What we can then decide is, do we want a further round of exchanges with Treasury on Tuesday or not? We don't want you flying in here for half an hour, unless you're in Cape Town anyway, right? So there's no need, it's not productive to bring two of you here for half an hour sitting. What we could do is by Monday morning at the latest, let you know, and we'll take into account that you've got other commitments, but we might want to at least informally adopt a report on Tuesday and vote on Wednesday. Whether you are here or not will depend on what comes out of what people say. But by Friday 10 o'clock, can I have it, please? Then you'll send it to the members, and then if they give a feedback that requires you to be here, because they're asking lots of new issues and so on, then fine. But otherwise, what I would like to suggest is that the PBO and the secretaries put together a fully fledged report on this issue. So then what we do is we meet again in around, let's say, September or so, and we pick up on these issues, because we're not going to settle everything before we adopt the in the house on the head, if all goes well. So those are things that I think, you know, it's a little scoff, but you might have things to say. But you can say whatever you want, obviously.
Thank you, Chair. It's past one, and we've got the bus running in the NCOP until the 26th of this month, of June. Thank you for your sharing this meeting, for the road players making the important inputs. You've got a very important role to play in society. You are also our eyes and our ears outside, and to bring issues to Parliament. The doors of Parliament is open for all South Africans, everyone. We are meeting next week on a weekly basis for the next couple of weeks, since we started your Finance Committee, the NCOP. So we will be dealing with this report as well. It was on Tuesday we've got the appropriations meeting with the same members of finance appropriations. So we will be dealing with her on the MOI's committee work on appropriations. Thank you, DG. You are here to account, but you honor the engagement. I speak to my work. And then on the members and staff, we've got two staff members that's very active, that will be running the comrades on Sunday, Simo. There he is, Simo. And very well represented and in the gender is Josh. She will also be running on Sunday. So when you so they're actually putting an example to us. You can start doing short distances. One day we'll come to the marathon.
Thank you, honorable members. That concludes the business of the music.
On the 10th of June, here at Spence Street, what used to be the disaster office, just around the corner, the Institute of Security Studies has come with a booklet. I think it's been distributed to members. It talks about budgeting and all the sides and so on. And they have invited members of the various film and finance committees. So it's from 12:32 with a lunch on the 10th of June. Now, as it happens, they asked me to speak. That's not the reason I'm asking to come. Actually, I said to them, get a higher profile speaker because you'll attract more people. People want to hear me. And they said, no, that's a good point, actually. It struck me a good point. They said, no, but what if it's handled by Parliament? How can you invite Minister Nene or the Deputy Minister? And it struck me, of course. So I said, fine, I'll speak. But how do you get somebody else? And I think they've got somebody else, whoever that is. But the reason I asked me to come is not because of that. It's just that it's up real as part of it. It's actually quite a nice piece of thing, paper, and useful to some of us. And I would urge that people come. You'll be pleased to know they're going to have it in the evening. I said, no, people have got buses to take back and whatever. Yeah. Then they said, morning. I said, no, it asked for 12:32. I think it said something of the mind member. Finally, I would like to apologize on behalf of the co-chair for the bad behavior of these committee members. I am a generous person and I accept
By the way, those of you that enjoy in Melbourne on Sunday, remember, that's our hometown.
I'm going to get away with the wheelbarrows. Are you going to have any wheelbarrows in? I will get an injection there of energy. I will be running there for us.
I'm going to go to the next one.